Welcome back to Inside the Hive. This is your co-host, Joe Hagan. It is August, dog days of August. I am technically on vacation, but I have returned to alert you that we are in reruns for this week. We're coming back at you next week with fresh stuff, but we want to remind you that we have an entire archive of still very relevant interviews and very fantastic interviews. This week, we're bringing you an interview I did with our very own Nick Bilton, who was the founder of this podcast, Inside the Hive, back in October of last year, a highly relevant, sadly, conversation about social media. Nick has been covering social media for several years. He's written books about it. He did an amazing documentary that was on HBO about influencers. And today you're going to hear this interview we did really about the power and the dangers of social media. The title of the original podcast is "The Only Winning Move Is Not to Play." This is a conversation that I think we'll be having, you know, for an entire generation, right? And so this is why this conversation remains relevant, and why I think you're going to enjoy it. So sit back, enjoy. If you're on vacation yourself, this is a good time, a way to relax. Just close your eyes. But if you're driving, keep them open. And enjoy this week's podcast. And we'll be back, Emily Jane Fox and I, next week with some fresh interviews for you. Today, very special day. We have back with us, right here, the OG, the original host of Inside the Hive.
Aren't you supposed to curse when you say OG? Like the motherfucking OG, or like, isn't there supposed to be?
Oh, I like that you're using the MF word right off the bat. Like, you know, not even giving the listener time to hide the children. We are here today. We're going to talk about a specialty of yours, at least as a reporter, social media, something you have covered for years, done documentaries about, written books about. And that obviously is in the news right now for reasons we're going to talk about. I just want to start off by telling you a quick confessional anecdote, which is like last weekend, I ran into a friend of mine on the street. And we got into a conversation. We were catching up and started to lament, you know, the existence of social media. And especially because we both have kids and you're always trying to like restrain and censor social media addiction in your children. And of course, we both felt good about ourselves in that moment. But in the course of the conversation, he also showed me a funny picture of Bill Clinton and Al Gore from the 1990s. And they were wearing these jogging outfits that looked really horrible hilarious.
Yes, I've seen those jogging outfits.
They have real short shorts on and they're sweaty and they have like big, supersized McDonald's Cokes in their hands. And it just struck me in that moment, oh, this, you know, you get excited when you see a picture like that. And you're like, oh, send that to me. And so he texted it to me. And what did I do? What did I do turn around and do?
Put it on social motherfucking media.
I put it on Twitter. And guess what? It went viral on Twitter because of just, I just put some funny thing about, you know, if your kids ever ask you about the 90s, show them this picture. That's and really it blew up all over Twitter. So what did I spend my weekend doing? Going to look to see it exploding, like as people retweet and like and tweet. And I became just a complete cautionary tale and a hypocrite and all kinds of other things, you know, just in this like singular moment.
How many likes and retweets and comments did you get?
It got up to about 10,000 likes and like, you know, 600 or 700 retweets, which is not even barely viral by today's standards of virality, but like, you know, in my little world.
And how many people called you every name in the book on Twitter in response for posting that?
Well, it was generally like, it wasn't too toxic, although people were like, that's not the 90s. This is the 90s in a picture of Pearl Jam.
Of course.
Or you know, like everybody had their own idea of it. And some people said, but, you know, for the record, it was a time of great peace and, you know, great time in the economy and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you get it. I get it. I was not trying to make any comment. I just thought it was a funny picture. However, I did think about this in terms of cigarettes. It's like people have made this analogy, but it was just like, I can't get away. I got to take another puff off this cigarette. I got to look at this again. And it's like, if I can't control myself, how can I expect my children to control themselves? Like they have no impulse control anyway.
Yeah. So we actually didn't introduce who I was. And for listeners that are not, haven't been listening to the show for, I don't know when we started this, 3 or 4 years ago. It's Nick Bilton. Feel free to attack me on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. But I wrote the book about Twitter, Hatching Twitter, which you can get on Amazon. Go for it. And so I've lived this world that you're describing from day one. The very first story I ever wrote as a journalist was about Twitter for the New York Times, and have covered the company ever since. The very first, I think, major magazine feature I wrote for Vanity Fair, or the second one, was about Twitter. And so like I've been living it. But what's really interesting is I have my own little anecdote before we get into the crux of why I'm here today, is I stopped tweeting during the pandemic. I was like, I don't need this in my life. I don't need these people coming into my living room with me and calling me every name in the book and making me feel bad about myself. I'm not going to tweet anymore. Deleted it from my phone, genuinely stopped looking at it, would maybe look for like a minute a day on my computer and was just like, this is silly. I have no interest. And eventually, you know, people would still tweet stuff about articles I'd written or if they'd read my book or watched my doc or whatever it was. And a friend of mine who worked for the government reached out to me a couple weeks ago and said, why haven't you tweeted in a year? And I explained, you know, I just don't need this. And he said, he's like, but if you're not going to tweet about, you know, all of the problems with social media and like help people think about it a little bit, like if everyone stops doing that, is thinking about this, then you're not helping the conversation. You're just sitting on the sidelines as it's doing all these bad things. You should tweet. And I was like, I just don't want all these people coming after me. I don't feel like dealing with it. It's just such a headache. And he really talked me into it. So the next morning I woke up and I sent a tweet. It was my first tweet in like 10 months and it went viral. And it was about some crypto thing. And the crypto lunatic douches came after me. And they were, and I texted him like screenshots and he was cracking up. But it's like, we've all been there. We've all experienced this. And it doesn't bother me anymore. It truly, honestly doesn't. It used to. And that definitely is something that came out of me walking away from it for 9 months. But if I were a teenager and dealt with that, it would be brutal. Like the things that people were saying, mm-hmm. like, woof, it's,
oh, yeah.
It's a dangerous place. It's a dangerous, dangerous place.
It is. And if you don't have a thick skin, which, you know, a lot of people don't, we're professionally obligated to have a thicker skin. But even then, you can be, you can, you know, if you catch you in the wrong moment, you can end up in a Twitter war.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
And this is really the conversation of the day. I mean, because as people who have paid attention to the news know, there have been some leaks from Facebook to the Wall Street Journal recently that described how they're getting away with all kinds of stuff that is toxic to their customers and toxic to the world and society at large, and they know about it. And they're not telling anyone. It just it actually reminded me. And there's one little sort of throwaway line in here, about Adam Mosseri, the CEO of Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, being asked, I guess, in a investor call, like about what do they know about the impact of the product on teenagers and children, and instead of pointing to internal reports that they had made, internal research that they knew was bad. You know, they point to outside research that was in favorable to them. So, right, there's, I mean, we expect these companies almost to be nefarious at this point. You know, we see what they're getting away with. We see the destructive outcome of so much of it on misinformation, on impact on teenagers. And yet we don't have a lot of recourse,
you know,
to do much about it.
It's what's really interesting is when you look at these companies, there's two aspects to this. The first is that, just to put into perspective how wealthy these companies are, if you take the FANG companies, Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, Netflix, Apple, there you go, Apple and Google, when you take them, their market cap, combined market cap is, I think, $7.3 trillion. And you throw in Microsoft and, you know, the next biggest company, it's over $10 trillion total. That's an astounding, astounding amount of money. On hand, Apple alone has $250 million in cash. You know, if you add up all of the cash these companies have, it's well over a half a trillion dollars in cash that's literally on hand. They're paying tens of millions of dollars a year in lobbying fees. They're hiring the former people they were lobbying against, you know, that work for these, you know, Jake Harney works for Amazon doing the communications, used to be at the White House. You've got the former heads of the FTC and FCC. It's like all working with Facebook, like, and they have just unlimited power. And there's nothing that can be done really to stop them. Congress could do something. The problem is that most of Congress is full of like 70 and 80 year olds that don't even understand which way to hold their phone up, like, to, you know. And so, so we're kind of left of the wolves in this regard. And I think that's the first part of this, which is, I think, really the worrying part. The second part of it is that if you look at the way these companies operate, what's really interesting is I know a lot of people that work at these companies, and they're good people. Like, they're just like you and me. They're like nice people. They, you know, they pay their taxes and they donate money to charities and, you know, they tip their waiters and waitresses and so on. They just have this weird perspective where they only talk, they drink the Kool-Aid and they only talk about and hear the good sides of things. And they believe, they truly do believe that they are on the right side of history. And what is so bizarre about that is when you talk to the leaders of these companies, they don't let their kids use the platforms. You know, Mark Zuckerberg would not put his kid's a toddler, but if he had a 12-year-old, I guarantee there's no world in which she or he would be using Facebook and Instagram, or Instagram for Kids if it existed. You know, I know so many people who work for these companies who are at the top echelon of them who literally will not let their kids on the platforms. Like a senior Facebook exec literally unplugs the Wi-Fi routers in their house at night, because they don't trust their teenagers on these platforms. And I think that's really telling to me.
Well, and why would they? I mean, these Facebook leaks, the research that was internal research at Facebook and Instagram, you know, one of the headlines on one was, "We make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 girls."
Yep.
I mean, what? I mean, and there's all kinds of other, you know, revelations in there. But even though all this came out, the fact of it is that they knew,
yes,
right? But the sort of sad thing is, we out here in the public, we already knew this. I mean, if you I have a teenage daughter. I have kids who are tweens, you know, and you know, they're all involved in the internet. They're involved in social media. They're, you know, because that's what all the other kids are doing. That's how they connect with their friends. And trying to keep them off of it is like, it's a Sisyphean task. I mean, it's impossible. Yeah. You know, the pressures are so intense, and the effect is so like a drug addict. It's so clearly like an addiction that it's very upsetting. And so, and just to the teenager again, just to talk first person and from my own experiences, like, I've seen how it shapes their self-image, how they dress, how they think. It's like the entire culture for teenage girls has congregated into these apps.
I think that the question is, and this is where I struggle with the answer, is, you know, if it wasn't for social media, but they would like unlikely be a Black Lives Matter movement. They'd unlikely be a Me Too movement. They'd, right. You know, they'd unlikely be these movements that have largely made society better. But at the same time, maybe there would. I mean, you know, it's like what I think has happened yeah. with right now. I don't have, so I think I've tweeted 4 times in the last month. It's like a shocking number for me, but I will not tweet anything personal and have a conversation. Like it's funny. My son, we have a 4-year-old and he's obsessed with the Hamilton soundtrack. He yes. wants to go see Hamilton, and I like Googled it, and it's like you should wait till your kids are 12. But he's like obsessed; he desperately wants to go see Hamilton. And I, you know, 10 years ago, I would have been like, "Hey, Twitter, what do you think? Should I take my 4-year-old to see Hamilton?" And now I thought about it, and I was like, "What am I doing? I would be like lambasted and chopped to pieces and sautéed with you know some yes. like spicy sauce." Like, I'm not asking Twitter yeah. that question. Like, and so. What has happened, though, is the replacement has become things like groups on iMessages, where groups of friends that I know are not going to cancel me for like asking a dumb question, or are not going to say I'm a terrible parent for asking, should I take my 4-year-old to see Hamilton, which we're not doing, by the way, although he's very sad about it. So I think that you can still have these social movements that happen that don't necessarily happen out in public. And I wonder if what we're seeing right now is the beginning of that transformation, where people are using these social platforms less because they've realized how bad they are and they're moving to these private platforms. But I don't know if that's going to make anything better or worse, honestly.
Right. And when I think about the positive aspects, the Black Lives Matter movement, even before that, it was the Arab Spring, you'll remember, was also part of this, you know, social media revolutions, it kind of turns these movements like Black Lives Matter into a meme, and then the meme travels, but it kind of travels on a pretty shallow level. I mean, the core of the revolution could have taken place without everybody feeling like they had to do a hashtag somewhere just to sort of signal virtue to people, you know?
No, you're completely right. I think it creates this false sense of protest where, you know, I remember the time where everyone was posting the black square on Instagram to say they, you know, did they go and like try to help someone who was in need because of who had been harmed? You know, it's like, no, they posted a black square and they went about their day and ate at Chaconi's and like, it's like, huh? What has that done? It hasn't done anything, I guess. Maybe it's brought more awareness to it, but it's at the end of the day, I don't think it really feels like it's that powerful to do that. I think that the other thing is like when you go back to the teenage girls thing, I think that to me was, you know, of all the information that came out of that Wall Street Journal series, and everyone should go read it. It's really fantastically done and incredible reporting. The teenage girl data was just shocking because I've always known it, but to see it from their internal sources and, you know, was mm-hmm. mind blowing, where they literally said a third of girls, young girls on the platform and women, have body images and feel sad and all these different things because of the thing that they're making. And I wonder, like, let's just change the word social media. If you took that Wall Street Journal story and you did a search and replace for Facebook and Twitter and social media with the word cigarettes, it would mm-hmm. be just chaos. People would be like, wait, a third of it's like killing our kids. We've got to stop this. It's like, what? But because it's kind of this innocuous, like little digital thing, it doesn't have any impact. And sure, Facebook said this week that they're going to pause making Instagram Kids, you know, for now, but I guarantee have me back on the podcast in a year and it'll be out. You know, it's like, it's
yeah. Pause. They're going to pause
exactly.
until this blows over.
And then they're going to put it back out there again. I think that the responsibility really falls on the individual at this point, because we can't trust the corporations to do the right thing. And we can't trust the government to do the right thing. And we can't trust, I mean, I actually thought that Kamala Harris, because she's actually very astute around these things, I thought she was going to actually take this on, and haven't seen it happen. She was, you know, I worked with her on some stories I did years ago about Google and Apple and some privacy issues that she literally took on and changed. And I thought that she was going to try to do the same thing when it came to these social media sites. And it hasn't happened. And Biden is way too old to even understand it.
Right. Well, as you pointed out, you're talking about, you know, political figures and looking to them for some sort of counter lever of power to kind of contain or regulate these people. But they're, you know, compared to the tech giants, they're like, you know, they have the GDP of their own country, and they operate almost outside of the law. I don't know if you caught, by the time this podcast comes out, maybe many people will have read it and made their summation of it. But Ross Douthat, the conservative columnist in the Times this week, he was very articulate in the way he kind of condensed some of the themes that you and I are talking about. But he says our internet behemoths are effectively immense media companies pretending to be neutral platforms, feasting on the revenue that once sustained the old media ecosystem while disclaiming normal forms of editorial responsibility. And I thought that was an interesting way to put it because, you know, one of the things that came out in the Facebook documents that while they are pretending to be neutral and disclaiming editorial responsibility, they are also actually, in fact, helping this certain group of influencers and people who make their business better, famous people, powerful people, giving them more freedom on the platform to get away with more things. Trump being, you know, number one for a long time. They call this the white list, right? The list of people who can get away with whatever they
and
want.
It's not a small list
on Facebook and Instagram.
It is 5.1 million, I think, something like that.
Wow. So they have their finger on the scales here, and as you said, that puts us in the situation of being the ones responsible. And in fact, Ross Douthat goes on to say, we can try to seal off. And he's talking about children. We can try to seal off more of childhood and adolescence from social media's reach. Well, that's where it gets just to be, you know, it is back on us. And at the top of this, I talked about my own little addictive moment there, right, where I lost my own self-restraint, mm-hmm. right? And you talk about cigarettes, you talk about, and I mean, the phone itself is like a cigarette too. It's like the whole thing, right, with all the apps on it and social media. And so, like, and parents, I know that there are parents out here listening to this who would be familiar with this, is like you're telling your children one thing and they're looking at you and you're doing the opposite,
yeah.
right? Because you're working, right? And as a journalist, of course, I'm almost like professionally obligated to be like looking at the news and pretending to be like completely on top of every little, you know, beat. But then I'm telling my children, don't do that in your own version of it, right? And it's incredibly frustrating. But do you think, and I want to ask you about this because you did a documentary called Fake Famous, which is about influencers, and which is really the kind of extreme sports version of this, right? It's like the desire for affirmation that social media inspires, the need. Yeah. You know, this is like people doing it almost as careers, and they're all in. Basically,
yeah.
And you kind of came away with that, and you were on this podcast a few months ago. And we talked about this, and you've said it here today. But how that opened up your eyes to how truly kind of evil this shit is, right? The social media, and you have a 4-year-old. What are you going to do when they're saying to you, "Every kid at school is doing it. We all want to connect. I feel lonely."
I have a 6-year-old, and he came home couple months ago and said, "Hey, can I get a cell phone?" And I was like, "No, you can't get a cell phone. You're 6 years old." And he was like, "Well, my friend has one." And I was like, I literally was like, "No, your friend does not have a cell phone." And it turned out the friend did have a cell phone and had gotten one at 5 years old. And that's mind blowing to me, honestly. But I think that it's interesting. So my wife and I are constantly getting into kind of debates and arguments about media consumption with our kids. And I always want to push the envelope and she always wants to pull it back. And they're 4 and 6 and they watch essentially Curious George and like Number Blocks on Netflix, which is like teaches kids how to do numbers. And she always says, you know, we're only watching something sweet. So once in a while, I'll like show them like The Incredibles, and literally, like, it's almost like they get handed a script with the movie, and they start beating each other up. And like, they're like, I'm going to be the bad guy. You're going to be the good guy. Let's fight. We're like, grab a weapon, you know? And
yeah.
and so we inevitably don't show them media like that. But what's been really interesting in this kind of experiment we've done is seeing the effects that the media does have on them at such a young age. And no matter what you show them, they will copy it. And so we try to show them these like Curious George things and things like that are kind and sweet and thoughtful and don't include weapons of mass destruction and so on and so forth. And you can imagine how fast forward to being 12 years old and you're seeing on Instagram people that you're skinnier than you and more handsome and on a bigger private jet and whatever, like, of course it's going to have an impact on you. It naturally is. And yeah. And doing the documentary Fake Famous, you know, the thing that had started that was that I had read this article about how 96% or something like that, I forget the actual number, around 90% of kids in America today want to be famous influencers more than anything else. And that's because they live in a world where that's what they see and that's what they think is what is going to make them happy. And it's not. It's all fake. It's none of it's real. It's just all completely made up with fake bots. And I mean, look, did you see that? Did you read the article this week about Carlos Watson of Aussie Media?
No, tell me about it.
So,
I did. OZY.
Yeah, OZY.
Yeah.
So, Ben Smith of the New York Times wrote it. So, Aussie Media is this former CNN columnist, Carlos Watson, started it and was looking to get funding from Goldman Sachs and had been faking what appears to be faking the numbers for the clicks on YouTube, and they're claiming that they had 25 million subscribers to their newsletter that no one I know on planet Earth reads. And they had been caught before faking the numbers on their YouTube views by buying fake clicks and fake views and fake comments. And they went as far as to fake a YouTube executive being on a call with Goldman Sachs by using one of those voice changing things. It's like they screwed up because they did a pretty terrible, pathetic job at their lie. But it's so easy to fake anything. And all people are doing on the internet is faking it. It's just all it is across the board. And it has a huge negative impact on our kids. And I think bringing this back to where I started this part of the conversation, we have made the choice to my kids don't play with my phone. They don't use my iPad. Like they don't, I wouldn't let them alone with YouTube. I'd rather let them alone with a weapon than you. It's like, you know, and it's like, it's incredibly dangerous stuff. And I wouldn't actually let them alone with a weapon, but you get my point. But I feel like we as parents have the most responsibility to ensure that we protect them from the media consumption that's out there because no one else is going to do it.
As you were saying all those things,
you had another tweet go viral.
I did. I wish. I don't wish. But you know what we're describing is children, but we are children too.
Oh, completely.
And we have acted like children, and this whole country is like a bunch of children. It occurred to me. I read this. There's a column that's made a lot of noise this week by Robert Kagan. It was a column in the Washington Post. He's a foreign policy thinker, and it was a very alarmist story about, you know, how Trump is going to and his minions and state legislatures and in the federal government are going to work to kind of like reposition him for the presidency again, and then this time kind of like crush, you know, voting rights absolutely and retake power and become a fascist state. And the way that Trump, you know, we've said this before and it's like a cliche, but he's really the kind of concentrated kind of outcome of a lot of the way social media has reshaped our politics and the conversation in this country. And his ability to make fake reality through social media and through other platforms has allowed him to reshape our body politic and reshape our whole you know, conversation in this country. I want to read this. Chris Hayes, this MSNBC anchor, wrote a piece in The New Yorker. I didn't even know he was a guy that wrote for The New Yorker, but he is. He wrote a piece about the internet, and I just want to quote it. He said, "Everyone is losing their minds online because the combination of mass fame and mass surveillance increasingly channels our most basic impulses toward loving and being loved, caring for and being cared for, getting the people we know to laugh at our jokes, into the project of impressing strangers, a project that cannot, by definition, sate our desires, but feels close enough to real human connection that we cannot but pursue it in ever more compulsive ways." And, you know, he's talking here about misidentifying the affirmation of the internet with actual human interaction, right? But that has expanded out and cascaded into how people feel about the way society should be structured and the way politics should go down and what's true and what isn't, right? People who don't believe in the vaccine feel connected to one another. And that has allowed Trump and people like him to make them a constituency and turn them into a hammer. Right. I mean, this is like, and I only say that all to circle back to the original point that I made to you, which is that in the face of this technology, we are all made into infantilized and turned into children who have impulse control, you know?
Yeah, I think that what's, you know, I may have said this before on this podcast at some point, but I'll say it again, because it's something I think about a lot is, do you remember that movie War Games?
I do.
And yeah. There's
Matthew Broderick.
And there's the game, the movie, for anyone who is young enough to not know it, on this podcast, essentially it's, Matthew Broderick plays this hacker who thinks he's playing a game with a computer. And it turns out he's playing a game with like his NORAD or something. And he may have just launched a nuclear strike against Russia, which in turn is going to launch him back and so on. And it turns out that there's this algorithm that has been created by this genius, you know, mathematician who has played out the scenario of how a nuclear attack could be won. And Matthew Broderick realizes in the process of playing the game that the computer has the solution to who can win. And the computer says the only way to win this game is to not play at all, because everyone will lose. And I think about that line a lot when it comes to technology today. I think that the technology is way more advanced than we are. It knows us better than we know ourselves. Virality is a perfect example of that. The algorithms serve up the extreme version of the thing that we click on, and it continues to serve that up. And whether you're on YouTube and it's the YouTube recommendation engine, or you're on Amazon and it's the book recommendation, or you're on Twitter or Instagram, especially with their, you know, recommendations, and it draws us in, and it really hurts our brains. Like, it really fucks us up. And I've come to the conclusion that the only way to play the game is to win is to not play the game at all. And so for me personally, I will not go to YouTube and look at the recommendation engine. I'll go and I'll look for things I want to look for, and that's it. I try not to click on the Instagram. I don't really post on Instagram anymore, but when I, you know, do look, I try not to click on that, because it just makes you feel like shit. And it's going to show you a better version of your life. It's going to show you a better version of you that you'll never attain to. And I just don't think you can win that game. And so you just can't play it.
Right.
And the challenge is teaching your kids that.
Oh, well, that is the as Ross Douthat also said, this is a generational project.
Yeah.
Right? This is a project that you and I having this conversation right now, people listening, people thinking about it and constantly thinking about it, is the way that we're going to get from one thing to the other. We have to educate ourselves constantly about what this means, and then also become aware of our own impulses. You know, oh, I look over here every time and I see these suggestions and I'm like a rat who just like wants another pellet and clicks over here. So don't be the rat, right? How can I not be a rat? I need to have impulse control. I need to be more self-aware and conscious of what I'm doing.
Completely.
Well, I hope that in the course of this conversation, our listeners will themselves think about that. My wife, she just erased her Facebook account this week. So for every person in the house who's doing the wrong thing, myself. There's one, at least one person doing the right thing.
Good for her. I mean,
good for her.
Yeah, good for her. I think my wife did the same thing and then accident and then regretted it because she deleted some photos. But I don't use it. I mean, I still have one because of like for work and just for reporting and you know. But I don't. Yeah. God, I can't remember the last time I posted on Facebook. And,
yeah.
And I think my hope is that. You know, there's a guy I knew who worked at YouTube. He was a big exec there. And he told me this story about how back when, you know, Q and all this like conspiracy stuff was starting out years and years ago, they knew about it. They like just didn't do anything. They didn't change anything. They just really ignored it and just kept along their happy way and whatnot. And even though like they came up in meetings and whatnot. And then there was something that happened where there was like, something really bad happening with some videos the kids were seeing. And it came to light in the media, and I believe it was Johnson & Johnson. I don't remember exactly who the advertiser was. It was a big advertiser like that. Was like we can't advertise next to that, and so they pulled their ads, and it ended up costing YouTube hundreds of millions of dollars. And they quickly changed everything and fixed it. And this guy ended up leaving YouTube, but told me the story about the only things he said, you know. There's only two ways you change this. One is if there's enough of an uproar that leads advertisers to pull, so it's a financial incentive. And anyone still advertising on Facebook, there's no, you know, they've already picked their poison at this point. But the other way is for the users. And if the users stop engaging with the platform, they have to change it. This is what happened, to bring this back to the very beginning of our conversation. Twitter user numbers were going down because people felt like shit when they used the platform and it made them feel bad. And they first tried to fake it. They got caught doing that. And then they actually started trying to make the platform better. And while I still think it's an incredibly vitriolic place to go and spend your time, they have done the work. They've started the work to try to make it a less vitriolic place. They hide like heavy criticism, they have filters, they surface things that are less negative and more positive and things like that. It's still got a million issues. But I think that, you know, if we want to see the change we want to see in this world, like it's kind of on us to do it.
Absolutely. I'm waiting to, and maybe I'm waiting for the wrong thing, but, you know, either in the form of a person, a manifesto, or a meme, for instance, some person who or idea that comes along that turns people against it, or more likely leads people to want to improve their lives by handling it more responsibly. Like there needs to be some guideposts that we create and that we popularize outside of them, because as you say, they're never going to do it exactly the way should be done because they have motivations that are money. So like on some level, somebody has to kind of like popularize it, make it into a revolution that would take your life back.
But it is, but you, the only way to do, I think like you just do it. If I don't click on Instagram, if I spend 20 minutes a day on Instagram, if I just choose to spend 0 minutes a day on Instagram, that's 20 less minutes a day that they get to say people spend on their app. If that times that by 1,000, times it by 1,000,000, times it by 10 million. Oh, we have a problem where we can't tell advertisers that people spend a collective 265 million hours a minute on our app. We got to fix something. And I truly believe it's up to us to do it.
Yeah, but we would have to do it in mass, as I'm saying, because
look at Twitter. It happened. People were so fed up with that platform that people who had been on there for 10 years were literally becoming, they weren't even, their daily active users went down, their monthly active users went down, right? These are people who had been on the platform forever. And so it got to a point where it was so bad that they had to do something. And at first they tried to lie, and then they now have tried to fix the platform. And so I think Instagram's probably a year out from that, in my personal opinion. Because everyone you talk to, they're like, oh, it makes me feel bad.
Yeah. Well, I have noticed over the last many years that the, or last couple at least, that the number of trolls have gone down generally, mm-hmm. In my feed. And
they're still there. Like, you just don't see them.
Yeah, I blocked him out, I guess. But here's what I'm going to do, just as a stunt here. I want you to tell me, give me some guidelines on what I should do on Twitter starting now. I tweeted this today. I tweet, I'm still at it. This morning I tweeted, Twitter, whenever I need a dose of we're so fucked, that we're so fucked feeling, you deliver, right? And because I still go there to feel bad.
Yes.
Right? But let me just start with my own behavior. Let me start with me. What do you suggest I do? Should I?
So I suggest you do two things. I suggest that, and I genuinely, I've been through this and I've done it and it works. You should delete the app from your phone for just a couple of weeks. You can still look at it on your computer. It's not as enjoyable as an experience, which is why you won't spend as much time on it. Literally delete it from your phone for and tell yourself, I'm not going to install it for a couple of weeks. You will have this thing happen where you'll click, you're doing it right now. I feel like this has now turned into a therapy session. Everyone listening, do the same thing. Delete Instagram from your phone. And now here's something that's really interesting. I've done so much research.
That's hard. That's a tough one.
But here's the thing that you need to do. You can still log in on your computer, right? You're just not going to spend as much time on them, on these platforms on your computer, because the user interface is not as good for a mobile experience. And that scrolling, like paperback-like feeling. You will immediately pick up your phone after we get up this podcast. And you'll go and you'll press in the place where the Twitter logo was. And your brain is—it's just like it's muscle memory. So what I did, and I spoke to like a neuroscientist about this, and he explained the whole thing. What I did was I put the Kindle app in the place of where the Twitter app was, and downloaded some like short story books and things like that. And so then I scrolled through those, and so you kind of create this thing. When you go back on and you re-download it in a couple of weeks, when you've like said, okay, I don't need to waste my time on this thing every 5 minutes, you should go into your settings on your phone and create an app limit of like 5 minutes a day or 10 minutes, whatever it is, the numbers that you feel comfortable with. And you can go in now and see what those settings are to see how much you use it now. And then it'll give you an update and it'll tell you like, okay, you spent 10 minutes a day. So I did this. I deleted it from my phone for actually quite a long time. I've deleted it many times, but the last time was for like 9 months. It was off my phone. And now I put it back on and I just don't use it as much. I pop in, I look for a couple of minutes, see if there's any new stuff, and I pop right out. And that's
you reprogrammed yourself.
You have to reprogram. You have to like hack yourself to make it work. So
I like that.
That's
idea.
My advice. So you'll have me back on in a few months, and we'll revisit where you are with all this.
Well, yeah, I would like that. Well, I'm going to try to while we were sitting here, just to be completely, you know, to fulfill my promise, because having you here is the pressure I needed. So I did just delete them both.
Right.
And in 2 weeks, we'll see where I'm at, whether I can stand it. Instagram's a tough one because, you know, that's like such an easy scroll.
That's such an easy scroll, which is why you need to replace it with a good book.
Okay, well, listen, I'm going to let you go, Nick Bilton, but I want to tell you, are you reading any good books that you can suggest to the listeners?
I'm reading a bunch of books right now on like Afghanistan and, you know, the Afghanistan paper, Steve Cole's book about the secret war. I'm reading one of my favorite writers, Alan Lightman. He wrote Einstein's Dreams. He has a new book out on the neuroscience of mystery, which I've been reading. But I need a really good novel to get my head into. So if anyone has one, hit me up.
This is probably not as lofty as some other works of literature, but I'm reading the novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood by Quentin Tarantino. And it is one of the most fabulously entertaining things I've read in recent memory. And to counterbalance that, so I don't become a complete, pulp fiction reader, I've been reading On Freedom by Maggie Nelson, which I highly recommend.
Cool.
So that is what we're going to say today. We've done as best we can to help you out there in podcast land. We're trying to help you out, you know. And thanks, Nick, for helping me.
Of course. My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And so have a great and fine week. And we will see you, dear listener, here next week when Emily Jane Fox, your regular co-host, returns. And that's our podcast this week. I'd like to thank Nick Bilton, the OG, for coming back on the podcast next week. Emily Jane Fox, the return of Emily Jane Fox. She's coming back. Thanks to producer Brett Fuchs. Thanks to Cadence 13, who helped make this podcast happen. If you like what you're hearing, hit subscribe. Come back week after week. Please support our sponsors the way they support this podcast. And we will see you next week.